Have you ever been close to someone as they're dying? Have you noticed that many suddenly become very lucid, saying things that might sound gibberish, but when taken in the context of an afterlife or of crossing over, make perfect sense? My interview today is with Lisa Smart, a linguist who became fascinated by the things we say as we approach our last moments. With Dr. Raymond Moody, the father of near-death experiences, NDEs, she began the Final Words Project. The idea is to compile our final words, find their lessons to help the rest of us with the process of life and death. I had a wonderful time with this interview. I hope you enjoy it. Lisa, could you tell us a little bit about the Final Words Project? Did I get this right that you've compiled 2,000 utterances from 1,500 people for your wonderful book, Words at the Threshold?
Yes. It's not 1,500 people, but about 200 people.
Okay.
So we've looked at the final utterances, and mostly loved ones transcribed the words for us, shared them, and we discovered some fascinating things about people's last words, what people see and say before they die.
And I really found your book a wonderfully objective investigation into our final words. It might be easy to go all woo-woo about this stuff, but you've kept it measured and, dare I say, scientific. Was that conscious?
It was conscious, and a very fascinating thing has happened for me in the last 6 years. Kenneth Ring, who is a near-death researcher for decades, has an expression, the beautiful virus. And this refers to the contagious quality for those of us who study the transpersonal aspects of death and dying.
Yeah.
And when he talks about the beautiful virus, is once you start researching this area as scientifically as you go into it, it's very hard not to be pulled into the powerfully spiritual and transpersonal aspects of dying. So when I first began my research, I was trained as a linguist, which is a relatively scientific pursuit. You know, you collect the data and you analyze it. And I really walked into my work that way. It began because when my father was dying, he was a skeptic, a scientifically trained psychologist, and he believed in nothing beyond the veil. He was very skeptical. And yet, in his last 3 weeks before he died, he began to talk to me about angels he was seeing, and his language shifted into some very fascinating metaphorical expression. And as a linguist, I was trained to write down what you hear, not to judge language. That's part of the scientific training in terms of the linguistics background. You don't say, oh, one bit of language is better than any other language, right? All language is like a natural, you know, it's natural phenomena, right? Language expression. So I just wrote down everything my father said. And I must admit, over the years, as I've been collecting the data, while I still always have sort of a scientific perspective, you know, I always have that analytical perspective in everything I do, it's been really hard not to catch the beautiful virus, because the more I study and the more data we collect, I'm just absolutely convinced that something was going on as we pass on. It says to me that there's more beyond the veil. Definitely.
Okay. You know, in meditation, we reach beyond the human ego into an experience of the soul, and it feels like that's what you're talking about. We're letting go of the masks of our everyday life, of our roles and labels, and we're sort of stripped bare. Does that resonate with the experiences of those of the Final Words Project?
It resonates in many ways to me. You know, in many Buddhist traditions, for example, there are koans, which are nonsensical phrases, and part of the intention, if I understand correctly, is to get us out of our linear view of things and out of our minds, right,
yeah,
and into
yeah.
something more expansive.
Yeah.
What's so fascinating about the language of the dying is a lot of it is paradoxical and nonsensical, much like koans. And oftentimes loved ones hear that language and they're scared or baffled because it's frightening to hear our father or our mother or our sister or our husband or wife start speaking what sounds like nonsense. And yet some of the language, if you look at it, almost has... are like koans. People say things that are contradictory. So what you're saying about the meditative process, I've seen also seems to happen at the veil, that people move outside of more literal, concrete, sensory-based ways of seeing things and start expressing things in really interesting language.
Do you want to ask what sort of things are people saying? Is there a common thread? I mean, does anyone, for example, ever get angry or feel scared that they might be going to eternal damnation or some kind of hell? Are those final words about, as you know, are there final words that are scary as well as those ones that are, you know, more loving? Or
absolutely, there are. Now, I'm the first to admit that while I try to be as scientific as possible in collecting my data, I asked people to submit data to me because it was very hard to get permission from hospices and hospitals to have a recorder near people's beds, for example.
Right.
So it really, some of the research is skewed in the sense that people shared their experiences with me. And I think in most cases, people want to share the positive experiences and not the more frightening ones.
Mm-hmm.
However, there were definitely people talking about how they were afraid, or people would swear, you know, things. There's no doubt about it that when we die, our physical bodies, I mean, we are physical as well as spiritual beings, and dying is scary, right? So, what's so interesting is there seems to be kind of a turning for so many people that there might be fear. And what you hear, for example, I just got an account, story in this morning, let me see, where the father was really, really afraid. Mm. And then at some point, he started talking about the big trip he was taking. And then he turned to, my father turned to me and said, tell John and Margaret we're at the point of departure.
Wow.
He had worked in airports all his life.
Right.
And had traveled a lot in his career. I was a little upset at the metaphor and asked him how he felt. And he said, with great deliberateness, curious about the next life.
Wow.
And at peace. And however, days before that, he was very agitated and uncomfortable. So, and he did say words of despair. So oftentimes we see this, that I think it's almost like the struggle of letting go of our bodies. I mean, that's what we know as meditators, right? It's hard sometimes to move fully into that space.
And I think, you know, like you're saying, death is almost taboo in the West, isn't it? You know, like so many people are, I wonder whether so many people that are dying are unable to fully express themselves, as they might feel that they're making us uncomfortable or perhaps we won't understand.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And part of my intention and with this work is that the more that we can be open to the expressions of our loved ones at end of life, the more we give them the space to go wherever they need to go before they die. And I've found that the more that people are open to hearing their loved ones' final words and the less afraid they are, the more expansive the experience is often for the person who's dying. And also, as the people we love enter into that vortex or into that expanded space, we are also touched by source, you know, I call source of the divine. So to me, it's very important that people, you know, as a linguist, I know there's no language that's wrong, right? So my invitation is that people open their hearts to whatever they hear and acknowledge and validate whatever the person's going through, because we really don't know what exists beyond the veil. We really almost don't know what's going on in this reality sometimes, right?
So absolutely. And, for reading the book, it seems almost like there is another language at the end, as if people are opening up to another dimension. Do you feel like it might be possible eventually to explore asking questions of those dying about what they're seeing, that we might eventually understand the language of the dying better? You say, for example, that children and the dying seem to share a common language.
Yes, yes. I interviewed people who, for example, a grandfather had a toddler on the bed with him. Mm. The family together. And the grandfather started to go into some gibberish or nonsensical language, which happens at end of life.
Mm.
And the toddler began to respond. And it was almost as if they had a dialogue and they were getting each other.
Yeah.
Right? There was some way they were connecting. And I've heard that before with other people. I mean, that was not the only instance of that kind of communication that I received.
And you speak of linguistic patterns of metaphor, of deep insight, of like almost intuitive insight, and also these other things you're talking about, like of nonsense, of gibberish. Can you enlighten us a little bit on the mechanics of the language? Is it simply the case that the language, you know, from the other side might seem ridiculously foreign to us, or is there more to it?
I think it's both. Some of it sometimes is absolutely ridiculous. But if we look at what seems, what looks like ridiculous on the surface, it may not always be as ridiculous as it looks. And let me give you a few examples. For example, there is something that I call paradoxical. I'm looking for some good examples here in my I'll do it from memory. For example, when my father was dying, he said, introductory offer, store is closing. Right? That's nonsense. That's paradox, right?
Right.
Introductory offer, store is closing. Yet we know people have near-death experiences. They talk about their experiences in very paradoxical terms. They say things like, when I had my near-death experience and died, it felt as if it were 10 seconds long, but also an eternity.
Wow.
Or I never felt as alive as when I was dead. Right? Wow. They say things that are completely paradoxical.
Yeah.
So if you start writing down some of the phrases of things that people say when they're dying that seem like sheer nonsense, in some cases you actually see patterns of language. And one of the types of patterns that we found is this kind of paradoxical language. The other thing is that people tend to combine the language of this world with some other place. So they may say something like, bring me the ladder, pointing outside. Let's say there's a ladder outside the window, as in one case. Bring me the ladder. I need it to walk up there, pointing up to you. So that's nonsense, right? Technically, that's nonsense. Please massage my feet. Oh, I'm sorry, love.
Oh, I was just going to say, but to a child, it would make perfect sense, wouldn't it?
You know, isn't that true? Isn't that the truth? And children, yes, and children have a much more, that's a very good point. And I think that's why children traditionally, Alice in Wonderland or Dr. Seuss, this is nonsensical literature for children. This is a really good point, Sunny, that children have such a different sense of language. You know, when we're little, we still have this almost playful, flexible connection to language. Yeah, that's very true.
Can I just back you up a little bit and perhaps ask you about the 200 people that you spoke to about this? And I just wonder, you talked a little bit about, that there are times when people have, spoken when they're close to death and they've been angry or they've been scared or whatever else. But I just wonder whether right at the end, whether there's a commonality to people's experience right at the end, like just before they pass. I know Steve Jobs, you refer to him saying, oh, wow, oh, wow, oh, wow, as the last words. I wonder, is there a commonality right at the very end?
Yes, there is. And other researchers support our findings. A very high percentage. There's this very large study done by Dr. Christopher Kerr in Buffalo, New York, in the States here, and I think it was 500 subjects, and 72% of them had visitations from loved ones just as they were going. And medical professionals, you even find it online at WebMD, you know, considered relatively mainstream. And what they say is that one of the indications that someone's going to die within 72 hours is they start speaking about deceased loved ones entering the room. And so that's a very, very common. I mean, they're saying over 70%. And that is true in our studies. We have found that so commonly people will start speaking. And that's often when you see a turning point where if there is discomfort or distress, as soon as people start talking about, oh, mom's here, or, you know, one case, one woman talked to her daughter and said, oh, I feel so much better. Earl is here. And Earl was the father. And people start having these conversations across the veil with deceased. So it's really, it's so remarkable. And many medical professionals I interviewed know this to be true and see it as one of the common signs that death is approaching soon.
Yeah, I was fascinated about, you were talking about terminal lucidity in your book, and I loved reading about that. Would you mind just explaining a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, terminal lucidity is oftentimes, from a few hours to a few days before someone dies, there'll be this window of time where the person is suddenly very lucid. And we see this even with people who are in comas. I have one example of someone who was in a coma for several weeks, and then she got up right before she passed and turned to her loved ones and said, I'm okay. Everything's okay. Tell everyone that I love them. And she went back to passed away. And there are so many stories I received like that. Now, researchers put estimates for terminal lucidity as low as 6% of the cases to much higher, to 60%. Mm. We received a fair amount of instances of that, but it also might be that people who experienced that were so struck by it that they were more likely to submit their stories. So I don't know exactly how common it is. We're just beginning research into the statistics, but it's definitely something that exists and is very real. And I personally saw many instances of people, and oftentimes people right before they pass will get very hungry, you know, where they may not have eaten for weeks or days at least. Wow. My father didn't eat for almost a week, and then he got up and was very lucid and asked me to make me his favorite pot roast and upside down pineapple upside down cake. Yeah. And I did it happily. And he sort of had like his last supper, right? His last meal. Yeah, and then about 2 years later, he passed.
Wow. Wow. Can I ask a little bit more about that? What are the important things to people as they're getting ready to pass?
Yeah, you know, one thing I find so interesting, at least about the cases I've collected so far in terminal lucidity, and many healthcare professionals have validated this for me, is that when people are in that window of time where they're lucid after not being lucid, they never say hateful words. You know, they never say, oh my God, your father was such a rat. You know, they never, it's always words of reconciliation. One case was, you know, for example, one woman turned to her daughter and said, no, I'm sorry I never told you that I love you. I've always loved you. I've always loved you. And then went back into a coma. You know, people always say things. As a matter of fact, my own father-in-law who said to me, I never realized how beautiful you are, right? Mm-hmm. He always was kind of full of me and teased me a lot about things. So, I don't have one case where someone turns to say something mean or mean or mean-spirited. And again, that might be my data skewed, but that's been validated by, you know, healthcare professionals and hospice professionals I've interviewed.
And what about people's connection with nature, Lisa? Is that something that that comes to the fore at the end as well?
That's a really good question. You know, I think so. You know, Raymond Moody, who worked with me, supervised a lot of my work, or worked with, you know, helped me with this work and guided me, and is now a dear friend.
Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about who Ray Moody is as well, if you don't mind.
Thank you. Dr. Raymond Moody coined the term near-death experience in 1975 in his book Life After Life, and he has since written, I think, 12 or 13 books about death and dying. And he's a psychiatrist, and he also has a PhD in philosophy. And we connected because one thing people don't know about him, his first degree was a PhD in philosophy, and he specialized in language. He had a love for language.
Mm.
And so we connected because we both share this love for language. And when I began researching my father's final words, I attended a workshop by Raymond, not knowing about his history with language. And he said during the lecture, "I've been looking for a linguist who might be interested in looking at final words with me."
Wow.
And I thought, oh my goodness, that's me. And so Raymond and I founded the Final Words Project together. And I've done most of the footwork. He's really busy, of course, with other things. But he was kind enough to act in a consulting capacity. You know, he would speak with me once a month. And what he noticed, when people die and have their near-death experiences, it's very common for them to see beautiful natural scenes, you know, beautiful, beautiful. And they describe it as being in high definition. You know, the colors are brighter than bright.
Mm.
And I noticed, too, when people are dying, you hear a lot of instances of landscapes. My father kept talking about this beautiful green dimension. And there were people describe sometimes seeing beautiful, as they're in their hospital rooms that are usually ugly, pale green, white walls, right? People describe seeing mountains or forests in front of them.
Wow.
I think that's a good question. And it does appear, not always, but it definitely is something that appears in the language and the visions of what people see.
And do you feel as though your research into the final words is validating Raymond Moody's work on, you know, with near death experiences, as though there are lots of parallels there?
Yes, absolutely. There are so many parallels. It's been really exciting. And what was really a blessing is that I came into this work, as I said, I was not, quote, a believer. You know, when I started, I came in as but then as I got to understand the near-death, so I came up with these characteristics of the language of the dying, and then at about that time I started working more closely with Raymond, and the overlaps were remarkable. So, for example, one thing that's common in the language of end of life is people start using prepositions very peculiarly, and prepositions, express our relationship in time and space. Mm. So words like up, down, and besides, and backwards, for example. So people will say things like, help me, I'm going up, I'm going up, or, I'm crossing up, or I'm moving backwards, you know, while they're just lying in bed, and their loved ones are saying, you're crazy, you're full of nonsense, right? Well, Raymond knows that one of the things that people talk about is moving, you know, out-of-body experiences, and people in a very real way are experiencing moving up or moving back or moving. So what appears in the language is strange use of prepositions, you know, may clearly reflect, for example, one of the first stages of the near-death experience, which is moving out of the body.
Yeah.
But there are so many overlaps. You know, we know that people talk about going through the tunnel and seeing the departed loved ones. And talking about loved ones, as I mentioned earlier, appearing at the bedside right before dying is so common.
Well, perhaps in summary, then, can you give us some way to find out more about your work? I know your website and your book is called "The Words at the Threshold." Perhaps you can let us know your website and any other way we can find out more about what you're doing.
Oh, definitely. It's finalwordsproject.org, and if people have stories or accounts to share, we have a tab on the website where they can share their accounts, and we would really treasure those, especially from very, very nonsensical language. If you think the language would not be useful to our research, think twice. If it doesn't make sense, we actually want to study that language. And let's see, where else will the book, and I offer a free chapter if people just want to take a look at the first chapter. And also, you can reach me at finalwordsproject@gmail.com if you have questions.